Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland. I'm Fraser, your historical guide through Scotland's rich and historic past. In our previous episodes, we have journeyed alongside kings and commoners, diving deep into the events that shaped this proud nation. Last time, we turned our gaze to the early to mid-reign of Malcolm IV, a king who rose to power from the lineage of the great David I, who happened to be his grandfather. His reign, marked by the youthful aspiration and the weight of legacy, offered a glimpse into the tumultuous period of Scottish history. As we prepare to unfold the concluding chapters of Malcolm IV's reign, it's essential to appreciate the landscape of 12th century Scotland. It was a time of shifting alliances, internal strife, and the eternal push and pull between the old ways and the emerging new order, that being the Davidonian Revolution with the Normans. Malcolm IV's reign, though often overshadowed by his grandfather's legacy and his brother's, William the Lion's, reign, was a crucial pivot point for Scotland. In today's episode, we delve deep into the mid to later years of Malcolm's rule. These years were not just a period of personal struggle for Malcolm, but a time of significant transformation for Scotland. Despite his reign being cut short, Malcolm IV's impact was profound, laying down the foundations for future monarchs, including the successor, William the Lion, who was his brother. William's tenure as one of Scotland's longest reigning monarchs begins in the shadow of Malcolm's rule, with a challenge to surpass or at least equal the legacy left by David I. As we explore this pivotal period in Scottish history, we'll see how a young king thrust into power navigated the complexities of ruling a kingdom in medieval Europe. We'll uncover the challenges he faced, both from within his court and beyond Scotland's borders. How did Malcolm respond to the pressures of kingship? What were the decisions and events that defined his reign? Join me as we pick up where we left off in 1139, at a time where Scotland was on the cusp of significant change. We'll travel through the corridors of power, into the heart of battles, and across the changing landscapes of a nation in flux. It's a tale of power, resilience, and the undying spirit of a young king in a rapidly evolving world. So, are you ready to continue our journey through Scotland's rich history? This episode is going to be split into two parts, this being part one and the second part coming later next week. Reason being is originally I wanted this just to be one episode called episode 43 and early death, but I've actually had to split this up. So this is actually episode 43.1 and early death, and then you're going to be having episode 43.2 and early death. So it's two parts. So that's why you're going to have a bit of a brace stop in the middle, well, at the end of the episode, but it's the middle of my script, just because it was going on a bit too long. Anyway, let's dive back into the story of Malcolm IV and witness the conclusion of his reign, a chapter that will not only end his story, but as I said, set the stage for a new era under William the Lion. As we re-enter the narrative of Malcolm IV's reign in the year 1159 AD, it's essential to understand the context of his age and the political landscape shaping Scotland. Malcolm was just 17 years old at this point, stepping further into the complexities of kingship and navigating the intricate web of nobility and governance. This was a period marked by a youthful king striving to assert his authority in a world of experienced and formidable players. Now, there is something I would like to correct from last week's episode. This being and involving Donnchad Mormor of Fife, whose influence over Malcolm IV was both direct and profound. Donnchad actually died in 1154 AD, having only served briefly as regent during Malcolm's reign. However, his role as a mentor during Malcolm's formative years, particularly as King David I's life drew to a close, was significant. His guidance during the transition from David I to Malcolm IV helped shape the young king's early approach to kingship and rulership. He was still in charge of the decision to get him crowned early and go on a tour of the realm, but he was really only the regent or the leading magnate for a couple of years. With Donnchad's passing, his son, Donnchad II, inherited the earldom of Fife during his childhood. This transition underlines the primogeniture practice that we've discussed in the past. This is where the firstborn child succeeds their parent in titles and responsibilities. However, young Donnchad II wasn't expected to lead Clan MacDubh, his king group, This role likely passed to his cousin. Conchad II, like his predecessors, was appointed as Justiciar of Scotia, a role reflecting his significant influence in the northern realms of Scotland. During Donchad's second minority, Perchar, Mormorer of Strathearn, emerged as a prominent figure, guiding the young King Malcolm IV. Historian Geoffrey Barrow notes that it was likely during Donchad II's tenure that the reign of Benoc MacDubh got its name, signifying the land of acquisitions and territorial expansions of the time. The Mormorers of Fife, including Donchad II, maintains close associations with the Scottish crown, a tradition that continued to influence the political dynamics of Malcolm's reign. So, that's a bit of correction done. So yeah, just a quick recap on that. Donchad I actually died a couple of years into Malcolm IV's reign. His son, Donchad II, took over, but was only a minor. So Ferchar, Mormor of Strathearn, took over as the leading magnate and leading regent during Malcolm IV's early reign. But Malcolm IV has come to age now anyway, so it doesn't really matter about having a regent. Regardless, we would like to extend our gratitude to our listener John for highlighting the need for this correction, ensuring the accuracy of our historical journey. Appreciate it, John. So, let's head back to our political drama. In 1159, another political drama unfolded in the heart of Europe, involving the ambitious Henry II of England and the contested County of Tolu. King Henry II, at the zenith of his power, had extended his influence not just over England, but across large swathes of France. His wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, brought significant territories into the Plantagenet fold, including the disputed territory of the County of Tolu. Eleanor's claim to Tolu was rooted in her grandmother, Philippa of Tolu, the only legitimate child of Count William. This claim was not merely symbolic, but represented a tangible assertion of control over a critical region. However, the County of Tolu, under the rule of Count Raymond V, proved a stubborn resistance point. Raymond's claim, perceived as a weaker, became the focal point of Henry's strategic ambition to extend and consolidate his empire. In this intricate tapestry of feudal Europe, Scotland's young king Malcolm IV found himself drawn into the fray. The reasons for Malcolm's involvement are multifaceted. Firstly, there was the feudal obligations tying Scotland to England, further complicated by the intertwining dynastic ties between the Scottish and English thrones. Malcolm's ascension to the throne under the guidance of his grandfather David I had seen a continuation of the close, a bit often strained relationship with England. Obviously, after the Treaty of Chester and Malcolm being recognised as Earl of Huntingdon, he became, in effect, Henry II's man. As stated in 1159, as Henry prepared to enforce his claim of Tolu, he called upon his vassals, including Malcolm IV. Malcolm's decision to join the siege was not merely a demonstration of fealty, but a complex manoeuvre in the high-stakes game of medieval diplomacy. Aligning with Henry II presented an opportunity to strengthen his position, gain favour, and perhaps most critically, ensure Scotland's interests were protected in the broader European context. However, Malcolm's involvement in a campaign so far from his realm was not without risks. It raised questions back home about the priorities of a young king, especially given Scotland's own challenges and the ever-present need for strong, focused leadership. The Siege of Tolu was more than a military campaign. It was a moment that tested Malcolm's kingship, his diplomatic acumen, and the delicate balance of power in medieval Britain and beyond. As Malcolm embarked on this significant journey to Tolu to join forces with Henry, he was not alone. His entourage was a reflection of Scotland's feudal structure and the king's need to demonstrate his capacity to contribute to such a major campaign. Gilbert of Galloway, as the formidable Lord of Galloway, Gilbert's inclusion was significant. His presence not only bolstered Malcolm's force, but also signified the unity of Scottish leadership. Herbert, Bishop of Glasgow, a key ecclesiastical figure, Herbert's participation highlighted the close ties between the Scottish crown and church, further lending a sense of legitimacy and divine favour to the campaign. And finally, Walter FitzAlan, the Steward of Scotland and an ancestor of the future Stuart dynasty. Walter's presence discovered the integration of Norman influence in Scottish affairs. His military expertise was invaluable. The contingent likely included other lesser-known but equally important lords, and some knights, representing various regions of Scotland. These names are lost to history, but they were nevertheless a part of this critical juncture. Malcolm's retinue was not just a military force, but a statement of his reign's stability and strength. Estimates suggest that the retinue could have numbered in the hundreds, a considerable force considering the logistical challenges of the time. These were mainly knights and men-at-arms, who were the backbone of the contingent, who were the warrior class, you know, the warriors, the spearmen, the light armoured units that we've mentioned in the past. The archers and infantry. These were obviously less more focused on killing mounted knights, but also playing against other archers, and these were quite crucial roles, especially in prolonged sieges like in Tullooh. And there was obviously support personnel. These support personnel included squires, cooks, blacksmiths and labourers. There was a few clergy and advisors along as well. So Malcolm's entourage thus was a microcosm of the Scottish feudal system. But do not be mistaken, this army was still relatively small compared to what Henry was bringing to the table and the might of the French army. The journey to Tullooh was such of a diplomatic endeavour as it was a military campaign, showcasing Scotland's commitment to its feudal obligation and the young king's willingness to engage in the broader political environment of the period. So in reality, Malcolm IV's involvement in the Siege of Tullooh was a testament to the intertwined fates of Scotland and England during this period. Bound by feudal obligations to Henry, Malcolm's participation was as much as a political statement as it was a military commitment. Malcolm's journey to the walls of Tullooh, through England, through English lands and across the Channel, was a display of solidarity with Henry II, underlining Malcolm's role as a vassal to the English crown. The Scottish troops, though a smaller part of the besieging army, played a crucial role in the operations around Tullooh, engaging in skirmishes and aiding in the siege's logistics. They demonstrated the military capability of Scotland under Malcolm's leadership. Their presence was a statement of Scotland's emerging role on the continental stage. But the Siege of Tullooh did not culminate in a grand battle or dramatic surrender, but in a strategic withdrawal initiated by Henry II. In this time, sieges were the more prevalent ways of warfare. Noblemen and kings didn't want to fight great battles of state because of the risk of how decisive these battles could be. Think back to our sadly deceased Malcolm III and Malcolm Canmore. In fact, David I was quite lucky to get away with his defeat. Anyway, with the arrival of King Louis of France in Tullooh, this posed a significant diplomatic challenge. Faced with the prospect of escalating his conflict with the French crown, Henry II chose prudence over conquest. The decision to lift the siege while averting a potential war with France was seen as a setback for Henry's ambitions in the region. The withdrawal of the besieging forces marked a diplomatic retreat, one that had implications for the Plantagenet's claims in the region. Back in Scotland, Malcolm's participation in the siege was met with mixed reactions. While some viewed it as a necessity to the allegiance to a powerful neighbour, others perceived it as an unwelcome entanglement in foreign conflicts. This involvement in the affairs of the Plantagenet Empire was a departure from Scotland's traditional insular focus, prompting a re-evaluation of its role and aspirations on the European stage. The Siege of Tullooh was a formative experience for Malcolm, offering him a first-hand look at the complexities of medieval geopolitics. It was a chapter that underlined the challenges of being a younger ruler in a world where dynastic ambitions often transcended national boundaries. For Scotland, it was a moment of stepping beyond its borders, hinting at the broader role it would come to play in the centuries to follow. As Malcolm returned from Tullooh in 1160 AD, he was immediately thrust into a significant domestic challenge. In Perth, he faced a revolt led by six influential earls, with Ferchar, Mormor of Strathearn, the grand magnate of the realm, at the helm of this revolt. This revolt was a critical test of Malcolm's leadership and the stability of his reign. The uprising at Perth was not just a simple act of rebellion, it was a complex interplay of power, ambition and the shifting dynamics of Scottish nobility. Ferchar, as a leader of this revolt, represented a faction within the Scottish elite that was perhaps resistant to the changes Malcolm IV was implementing and even David I, and he was maybe seeking greater autonomy and influence. The inclusion of six earls in this revolt indicated widespread discontent or strategic manoeuvring against a young king. Ferchar's role in the conflict was layered, as a Mormor of Strathearn he wielded significant power and had been guiding the young king Malcolm, especially in the wake of the death of Donnchad I and the minority of Donnchad II. His decision to lead the revolt suggests a deep-seated ambition or a profound disagreement with Malcolm's policies. This period of Scottish history was marked by a delicate balance of power, and Ferchar's actions during the siege was emblematic of the tenacious nature of Malcolm's authority. The siege itself was a bold challenge to Malcolm's authority. By choosing to besiege the king in Perth, the rebellion earls were making a clear statement about their grievances and their power. The event raises questions about the involvement of Norman lords and the eventual resolution of the conflict. The involvement of Norman lords in the Perth siege is a matter of historical interest. While the primary sources do not explicitly detail the participation of specific Norman lords, it's plausible that some were involved, given their growing influence in Scotland. The Norman nobility had been gaining prominence, especially after the reign of David I, who had welcomed many Normans to Scotland and granted them lands and titles as we know. Their possible involvement in the siege could have stemmed from various motivations, which include the allegiance to the king, personal ambitions, or even regional loyalties. The resolution of the siege at Perth is a testament to the influential role of the church in medieval Scotland. The intervention of the church was pivotal in achieving a reconciliation between the rebellion earls and King Malcolm. The intervention likely involved negotiations and assurances from both sides, with church leaders acting as mediators. The church's ability to broker peace highlights its moral authority and its capacity to influence both secular leaders and the nobility. The lifting of the siege without severe retribution against the leaders, particularly Ferchar, indicates Malcolm IV's strategic approach to governance. Instead of opting for punitive measures which could have exacerbated tensions and led to further conflicts, Malcolm sought a peaceful resolution. This decision might have helped stabilise the situation, preserving the delicate balance of power in a kingdom where the king's authority was not absolute and where the nobility, including the Norman lords, wielded significant influence. Ferchar, despite his leading role in the siege, remarkably faced no severe retribution, as we said, for his actions. In a turn of events indicative of the political astuteness of the time, he and the king were reconciled. This reconciliation points to a pragmatic approach by Malcolm, perhaps recognising the value of stability and the dangerous consequences of punitive measures against powerful nobles. Ferchar's future in Scottish affairs post-siege was significant, especially in the ecclesiastical matters. His influence was instrumental in the creation of a separate diocese of Strathearn, overseen by the bishops of Dunblane. This move highlights the intertwining secular and religious power in medieval Scotland and demonstrates Ferchar's continued prominence in the kingdom's affairs. Now, let's touch upon some of these other major lords and their influence slash opinion on Malcolm. Let's head back to the famous, or soon to be famous, De Bruce family, or the future De Bruce family, whose reconciliation with the Scottish monarchy, particularly during Malcolm IV's reign, is a fascinating tale of shifting allegiances and political survival. Casting our minds back, following the Battle of the Standard in 1138, where the elder Robert de Bruce opposed King David of Scotland, the family's fortunes in Scotland were uncertain. However, Robert II de Bruce, the younger member of the family, managed to navigate these troubled waters successfully. Robert II de Bruce's allegiance remained with Scotland, despite his father's opposition to King David. This loyalty proved beneficial, as he inherited his father's Scottish lands, while the English territories were passed to his older brother Adam. Robert II's tenure was marked by consolidation of his position in Scotland, particularly in Arndale, where he established Lochmaden as the chief seat. As a legend encapsulates the tumultuous times and pressure on nobles like Robert II, it's said that St. Malkley visited Robert II at Annan, implored him to spare a fief. Robert's refusal and the subsequent execution led to a reputed curse from St. Malkney, symbolising by the destruction of part of his castle by the River Annan. This tale, while possibly not true, underscores the complex interplay of politics, morality and religion during the era. Robert II eventually married, and he had three sons, Robert, William and Bernard. His burial at Gisborough Priory, a foundation of his father, signifies a continuation of family tradition, with his elder son predeceasing him. William became his successor, ensuring the De Bruce influence continued in both Scotland and England. The De Bruce family's journey from the opposition to reintegration reflects the broader dynamics of Malcolm's rule. Malcolm inherited a kingdom with complex feudal loyalties, and he had to navigate these challenges. The De Bruce family, once at odds with the Scottish crown, became integral to the kingdom's stability under Malcolm's rule. Their journey from adversaries to allies highlights the flaccid nature of feudal allegiances and the importance of political adaptability. Malcolm IV's reign was marked by the interaction and influence of other several key noble families, both of Norman and Celtic Scotto origin. Their perspectives and roles during the rule were pivotal in shaping the kingdom's dynamics. So if we just quickly go over them, we obviously had the Balliol family. The Balliols were among the most prominent Norman families. They held substantial lands and were influential in court politics. Their perspective towards Malcolm's reign was likely geared towards consolidating their power and expanding their influence. The St. Clair family, or known as the Sinclairs, known for their strategic matrimonial alliances and marriages and their military prowess, the Sinclairs were among significant Norman influence in Malcolm's court. And then we had the FitzAlan family. They held key positions and land, and the FitzAlans were integral in the Norman administration of Scotland. Their support was crucial for Malcolm in maintaining the feudal system and implementing Norman governance methods, and obviously they'd be known as the Stuarts later down the line. We had the Mormerers. These were Gaelic nobles, such as the Mormer of Fife and the Mormer of Strathearn, who played vital roles in upholding the Gaelic traditions and laws. Their support or opposition significantly impacted Malcolm's rule. We had the MacWilliam clan, who were descendants of our long-deceased King Duncan II, who the MacWilliams were prominent Gaelic figures. Their stance on Malcolm's rule was crucial, especially in the northern regions where Gaelic culture was dominant. We also have the Macduff family. As one of the oldest Celtic Scotto lineages, the Macduffs held considerable sway, especially in areas less influenced by Norman culture. Some of the key advisors we've already mentioned. We mentioned Gilbert of Strathearn, who was the leading Gaelic noble. Gilbert's counsel was vital in matters concerning Gaelic law and customs. We had Richard de Beaumont, a Norman advisor. His experience in European-style administration and military organisation was invaluable to Malcolm. We had Bishop Arnold of St Andrews, a religious figure. Arnold's advice was crucial in matters of church and his relationship with the crown. And then we had Hugh de Morville, who held lands in both Scotland and England. The de Morville's perspective was essential in maintaining a balance between Scottish independence and relations with England. Malcolm's reign was a period of navigating these diverse interests. The Norman families, with their feudal approach, sought to strengthen their position within the Scottish hierarchy. In contrast, the Celtic Scotto nobility aimed to preserve their traditions and autonomy. The King's Council, comprising of individuals from both backgrounds, played a crucial role in advising and influencing Malcolm's decisions, which were often a balancing act between these varying perspectives. This period was thus marked by a delicate interplay of Norman innovation and Gaelic tradition, shaping the direction of Malcolm's reign and the future of Scotland, and really, if you think about it, following in his grandfather's footsteps. In July of 1163 AD, a significant event marked the reign of Malcolm IV. He journeyed to pay homage to Henry II, a testament to the complex relationship between Scotland and England as we know. It was during this political endeavour at Doncaster that Malcolm's health took a dire turn. The exact nature of Malcolm's illness remains shrouded in historical ambiguity. The chroniclers of the time do not provide a specific diagnosis, leaving us to speculate based on their descriptions of his symptoms. His condition was severe enough to be noteworthy, indicating a serious ailment. Malcolm's frailty is a recurring theme in historical accounts. This frailness was not just physical characteristic, but perceived as a reflection of his capacity to rule. In the medieval period, the health and vigour of a monarch were often equated with their ability to govern effectively. A king's physical weakness could be seen as a metaphor for political or moral weakness, making them appear vulnerable to both internal factions and external adversaries. For Malcolm, being frail in a period marked by intense political and military challenges was particularly problematic. His physical condition likely limited his ability to lead military campaigns in the future, a key expectation for future medieval kings. This could have affected his standing among the nobility as well, and the military class, who valued physical prowess and leadership on the battlefield. Moreover, Malcolm's illness during a crucial diplomatic mission could have been interpreted as a sign of vulnerability or weakness by Henry II, potentially undermining Scotland's position further in negotiations. It also raised questions about succession and stability in Scotland, casting a shadow over Malcolm's reign during a period when strong leadership was vital for the kingdom's stability and integrity. But he eventually recovered, paid his homage, and returned back to Scotland. The latter part of Malcolm IV's reign was marked by a significant challenge, a revolt in the region of Moray. This northern Scottish province had been longer hotbed for resistance and power struggles, a legacy that can be traced back to figures like Macbeth. Its strategic importance and history of autonomy made it a recurring focal point of internal conflict in Scotland. But we're going to leave this here. So this is the end of part one of Episode 43, An Early Death. So I repeat, this is the end of episode 43.1, An Early Death. Thank you very much for listening. As always, please make sure you leave a review on your suggested podcast platform, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, or Google Podcasts. Thank you all for the recent support on Facebook, Twitter, and all the recent reviews coming in. I went through our Spotify Wrapped as well, and it's really cool to see how many listeners we are the top fans of. It's really great to listen to. Next week, as I said, we'll carry on with part two and discuss this, well, this revolt in Moray. What's going to happen? Is Malcolm going to crush this revolt, or is he going to die and fail his grandfather? We'll find out next week, because yes, there will be an episode next week continuing this, being episode 43.2, part 2, An Early Death. Well, we'll not only discover what happens in this revolt in Moray, but we'll finally close the book on Malcolm IV and set the stage for King William the Lion, one of Scotland's longest ruling monarchs. So be ready for that, because I'm honestly, I can't wait. As always, your feedback is invaluable to us. Please do review us if you can, as I mentioned. Follow our Twitter account at The History of SC1. Join our Facebook group at The History of Scotland Podcast. And yeah, thank you for joining us on this journey through Scotland's past. Have a great week, guys, and we'll be back next week with part two of this episode. Thank you, everyone. Stay safe, and I'll catch you later. Peace.